Hello, this is Atta Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, July 14th, 2026, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page, Community Painting Pages of the Past. Mural celebrates Decatur Public Library's 150 years. This article's by Donette Beckett, Decatur. Patrons at the Decatur Public Library can watch an artistic creation come to life. As part of a mural commemorating the country's 250th anniversary and the library's 150th birthday, local artist Shannon Cook has been painting colorful historical images on a wall near the library's history room. The process may take up to 3 weeks to complete. "Once I get into the detailing of stuff, it's probably going to take a while," she said. "It's nice to paint in public, but it's still kind of nerve-wracking." Cook was selected from a list of other artists who applied for the project. Her work can be seen in other areas of Decatur, including on the walls at Door 4 Brewing Company. The library staff offered suggestions to her submission. "I just had the color blocks. It was their idea to put historical images in them," she said. "I think it makes it really cool. Representation of the library's history and impact on the community was the focus," according to Rebecca Damptz, head of archives and special collections. "We've been doing stuff for the community for years," she said. "This is kind of the grand finale of 150 years. One of the images that grabs the viewer's attention is the brown lounge chairs used to relax while reading, dating back to the 1980s. "That chair took me a couple of hours to paint," Cook said. The process of creating a mural doesn't start with drawing the images. The Decatur Public Library was contacted by the Decatur Area Arts Council with the hopes of using funds from the Illinois Arts Council's America 250 Public Art Grant. Decatur Library was one of 22 public art projects throughout the state awarded more than $325,000 worth of grants. The awarded projects, selected in collaboration with local municipalities and nonprofit organizations, will serve as a public testament to Illinois' creativity and values, celebrating the state's role in the nation's ongoing story, the Illinois Arts Council stated in a news release announcing the grant recipients. "Their work helps us better understand the American story and the world around us," Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton said. According to Damps, the library received a $15,000 grant for the mural. However, the library board was required to ask the city of Decatur for approval because the city owns the building, Damps said. After a few meetings, the city council voted unanimously to allow the mural's installation as part of the grant agreement. However, the library is required to host an open house for the mural's introduction. The open house will be announced at a later date. And there's a medium-sized color photo, several of them actually, but we'll start with this one. Local artist Shannon Cook paints a mural by the Decatur Public Library's Local History Room on Thursday, July 9th. The painting, funded by the Illinois Arts Council's America 250 Public Art Grant, depicts the history and impact of the library. And this is a wide shot, so we see not only the mural wall, but then the part of the history room on the left and on the right, some of the shelves and other open space, and there's yellow streamer tape around the artist to block off anyone walking into the area. She's painting on the wall. It's an open book, and she's painting on the what is the cover, and then there's shelves of books painted. The brown chairs from the 1980s referenced shown in the lower left corner of the wall. And just an explosion of color as well. And Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, photo credit. And a close-up of the artist in the large photo that leads off the article here. Local artist Shannon Cook paints a mural at the Decatur Public Library on Thursday, July 9th. And this is a close-up of her detail work. So her right hand is shown with the brush tipped upward, the bristles on the word Decatur, on the D, the lower part of the D, for Decatur Public Library, on the front cover of the book she's painting on the mural wall. And it's kind of an orange cover, yellow spine, and orange on the back, but a darker orange because of the shading. And in her left hand is her palette of colors. It's very, very colorful, as you can imagine. Joseph Ressler Photos, Herald and Review. Congress, Graham's death opens powerful Senate vacancy. This article is by Zachary Schirmelli, USA Today, Washington. The sudden death over the weekend of Senator Lindsey Graham sent shockwaves through Capitol Hill, leaving lawmakers reeling from the unexpected passing of their longtime colleague. It also opened up, at least temporarily, an important vacancy atop a key Senate committee, one that's increasingly an architect of some of the most consequential legislation among affecting American lives. The South Carolina Republican was the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. The panel may sound like just another wonky corner of Congress, but it's much more than that. It's also the place where President Donald Trump's biggest second-term legislative wins originated. That's because budget bills need only a simple majority to survive, unlike other legislation in the Senate that requires 60 votes. Congressional Republicans on Trump's orders have become more and more accustomed to muscling big party-line bills through the all-important Budget Committee. They've used that process, known as reconciliation, to slash hundreds of billions of dollars in federal spending and send $70 billion to Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol. Just days ago, the president again directed them to use the Senate and House Budget Committees to try and pass a $350 billion Pentagon cash infusion in the coming months, all of that on top of a long-shot effort to pass a voting restrictions bill. Whoever replaces Graham leading the Budget Committee will play a key role in delivering on those GOP priorities, or trying to. Among the other long-serving Republican senators on the panel are Mike Crapo of Idaho and Chuck Grassley of Iowa. However, both are already chairmen of other important committees. With their plates full, Senator Ron Johnson, Republican Wisconsin, is expected to take over. Senator Johnson is prepared to serve as budget chair when announced, Grace Carnathan, a spokeswoman for Johnson, said in a statement to USA Today. Rounding out the GOP senators on the committee are John Cornyn of Texas, Mike Lee of Utah, John Kennedy of Louisiana, Pete Ricketts of Nebraska, Bernie Moreno of Ohio, and Rick Scott of Florida. Before his July 11th death, Graham helped push two major GOP policy accomplishments across the finish line. The first one was the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which was rebranded by Republicans as the Working Families Tax Cuts Act. The massive piece of domestic policy legislation passed a year ago, reshaping the country in profound ways, from Medicaid and food stamp cuts to a federal student loan overhaul. Democrats often call it the Big Ugly Bill. The second bill Graham helped steer was the Secure America Act, which infused federal immigration enforcement agencies with an additional $70 billion. It passed both chambers of Congress earlier this summer, even though Democrats boycotted it, saying they wanted significant reforms to ICE. On the night Republicans approved the legislation in the Senate, Graham had accused Democrats of obstructing the normal bipartisan process for appropriating federal money. In his view, that defiance forced the GOP to take extreme measures and go it alone. Why are we here? Through the normal appropriations process, Democrats would not give the Border Patrol or ICE one dime, he said on the Senate floor. It just didn't work. Legal briefs, COD, Nelson Park Boat Ramp Improvement. City of Decatur invites MBE and WE businesses to partner with Christy Foltz for Nelson Park Boat Ramp upgrades. Contact Tyler McLean by July 22, 2026 for subcontracting and sheet piling, rebar, and trucking. Proposals must consider bid, schedule, and prior Project Experience, contact 740 South Main Street, Decatur. Middle East, Trump renews Iran blockade. He vows Strait to stay open to traffic after new clashes. This article is by Elweli Elweli, Tala Ramadan, and Catherine Jackson, Reuters, Dubai. President Donald Trump said Monday the United States reinstated its blockade of Iranian shipping in the Gulf and would ensure the Strait of Hormuz stays open after the two sides exchanged more missile and drone attacks. The latest hostilities followed an announcement by Iran over the weekend that it closed the strait and cast further doubt on the viability of an interim deal to halt the war in the Middle East and drove oil prices higher. The Hormuz Strait is open, and open is in all caps, and will remain open, again in all caps. With or without Iran, we are reinstating the Iranian blockade, and the Iranian blockade is all uppercase. Trump said on social media, the USA will be, from this point forward, known as the guardian of the Hormuz Strait, and that's all in caps. But as such, and as a matter of fairness, and fairness is in uppercase, will be reimbursed at the rate of 20% on all cargo shipped. Iran's top joint military command said the U.S. had no role in determining the future of the vital shipping route and said in a statement on Monday it would not be allowed to intervene in the management of the strait. The Revolutionary Guards said on Monday they targeted U.S. military facilities in Bahrain and Kuwait, destroyed radar systems in Oman, and hit fuel tanks and ammunition depots at Prince Hassan Air Base in Jordan in response to U.S. airstrikes. The U.S. military said it struck Iranian air defenses systems, coastal radar sites, missile and drone capabilities, and small boats on Sunday using aircraft, naval vessels, and drones. On Monday, the U.S. attacked military sites in southern parts of Iran, including Keshem, Bandar Abbas, and Abadan, Iran's official news agency, IRNA, said, citing a local official. Bahrain said its air defense systems intercepted several Iranian missiles and drone attacks early Monday. The latest exchange marks an escalation in both the pace and geographic reach of attacks over the past week, throwing into question an interim U.S.-Iran agreement signed last month to open the strait and halt hostilities while the sides pursued a further 60 days of negotiations. Trump has said he considers the ceasefire over while leaving the door open to further talks. We had a deal. It was a done deal, and then they broke it. They always break it. We've had 10 deals with these people, and so we're just going to hit them very hard, he said in a phone interview on Fox News' Fox and Friends program on Monday. Iran's top negotiator, Mohammad Bakir Khalibaf, struck a similarly defiant tone, posting on social media Sunday, the era of one-sided deals is over, and over is in all caps. We told you, keep your word or pay the price. Reality is knocking. The war launched by the United States and Israel against Iran on February 28th destabilized the Gulf and spread across the region, with Iran attacking U.S. bases in multiple countries. In Yemen, the Iran-aligned Houthi movement accused Saudi Arabia on Monday of launching airstrikes against the international airport at Sana'a, and vowed to retaliate, testing a truce in a conflict between the kingdom and the militia group. Oil prices jump. Control of the Strait of Hormuz, a vital waterway for global oil supplies, became one of the main battlegrounds of the conflict. Iran's effective blockade of the strait pushed up energy prices and increased concerns about inflation globally. Brent crude jumped by more than 4% on Monday on Trump's latest comments and on fears of disruption to one of the world's most important energy shipping routes, though prices remained below the peaks reached earlier in the conflict. Higher energy prices, particularly gasoline costs, are politically sensitive for Trump before congressional elections in November. After announcing the strait's closure on Saturday following what it described as an unauthorized transit, Tehran said on Monday it continued to control the channel. We continue to assert our authority and control over the Strait of Hormuz with strength and power, and we will fight. We will force foreigners and their allies to surrender to the will of the Iranian people, Hossein Mohebi said in comments carried by state media. Thousands of people have been killed during the war, mainly in Iran and Lebanon. On Monday, Iranian state media confirmed the deaths of two people in Abadan in southwestern Iran. Straight Traffic, Iran's Revolutionary Guards, said in a statement Monday that the only way to restore regular shipping traffic through the strait was to end U.S. military interventions in the waterway, and warned that continued interference could lead to greater incidents in the global oil and gas sector. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Baghaei said Iran sought to establish a joint mechanism with Oman to manage traffic through the strait, adding that U.S. pressure on Oman hindered discussions. Iran sought to establish a permanent fee and permit system for vessels using the strait, which before the war carried about a fifth of global oil and liquefied natural gas shipments. The U.S., which revoked a license waiving sanctions on Iranian crude sales last week after earlier attacks on shipping, said its forces were positioned to safeguard freedom of navigation. U.S. officials said about 20 vessels were escorted through the strait in the previous 24 hours, though ship tracking data showed little traffic moving. Marine Traffic said Monday that vessel activity through the strait declined by about 52% over July 10th to 12th compared to the previous week. Moving on to page A2, State and Nation from the State House, due process in question for Welch in Ammon's case. This article is by Rich Miller. Representative Luis Arroyo, Democrat, Chicago, was arrested by the FBI on October 28, 2019 for attempting to bribe a state senator, House Speaker Michael Madigan, who was under investigation himself, called on Arroyo to resign that same day. The next day, Representative Chris Welch, Democrat, Hillside, was one of three House Democrats who signed a petition to automatically trigger the creation of a special investigating committee. Welch and the two others included in the sworn federal criminal complaint against Arroyo's evidence. Arroyo announced his resignation just hours before the first investigating committee hearing. He was later sentenced to almost 5 years. On February 25th of this year, Welch, without an announcement, kicked Representative Harry Benton, Democrat Plainfield, out of the House Democratic Caucus and stripped him of his committee assignments and House staff support. In April, my colleague Isabel Miller asked Welch if Benton should resign, but he wouldn't respond. On July 1st, Welch announced he'd received an inspector general's report and demanded Benton resign, which Benton did 2 days later. And that brings us to Representative Carol Ammons, Democrat, Urbana, who was indicted last week by the feds on multiple charges, including paying her daughter more than $15,000 from her campaign fund, disguised as a payment to what appears to be a non-existing consultant, and then allegedly received kickbacks. Ammons is also accused of killing an appropriation for the Urbana Neighborhood Connection Center, and in its place arranging more than $650,000 in the fiscal year 2020 budget for Hood Vote for Neighborhood Transformation. And then her daughter was paid out of that appropriation. Governor J.B. Pritzker's administration figured out what was going on and told Ammons that the group that this was an impermissible conflict of interest. Ammons' daughter left the payroll. The next year, Ammons allegedly inserted a $612,000 grant to Bridgewater Sullivan Community Life Center into the state budget. Ammons allegedly then assisted the group in drafting the contract to hire her daughter and allegedly received kickbacks. That same daughter was also paid about $10,000 by the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, which Ammons helped with budgetary member initiatives totaling $700,000 in fiscal year 21 and fiscal year 22. The feds allege that, in total, Representative Ammons and her daughter received benefits in excess of $100,000. The G allegedly has multiple state messages that implicate Representative Ammons. She's also accused of lying to the FBI when she said she had no knowledge of any conflict of interest with the Hood Vote group. Speaker Welch told reporters last week that he wouldn't call for Representative Ammons' resignation because she has the right to due process. I asked a day later how a still-secret legislative inspector general report would qualify as due process for Benton and a public federal grand jury indictment does not for Ammons. I was told by a Welch spokesperson that the speaker considers the federal indictment akin to Welch's own referral to the LIG. And then the adjudication happened during the LIG's investigation and report. Seems a bit of a stretch. Speaker Welch told reporters he'd consider a special investigating committee to be due process if members demanded it. The special investigation committee can ultimately lead to a House floor vote to expel Ammons. However, Welch also told reporters, I think the court is the proper place for this. They have the tools available to them, and it's the proper place. Welch had basically the same response when he chaired the Special Investigative Committee looking into Speaker Madigan's operation. But unlike Ammons, Madigan had not yet been indicted. Also, the House voted to expel Representative Derek Smith, Democrat Chicago, after his arrest and before his federal bribery trial. And Governor Rod Blagojevich was impeached and removed from office before his federal trial. The argument doesn't really hold water. On Friday, Republicans filed paperwork to initiate the investigating committee. Welch appointed members to it that same day. And that finally brings us to President Donald Trump. We've seen serious problems at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago the past several months, and in my opinion, believable allegations have been made of politically motivated prosecutions. The Ammons indictment was filed by the Central District of Illinois. I've seen nothing yet which indicates that office is having the same problems as the Northern District, but an argument will likely be made that this is yet another politically motivated Trump-era indictment, and people should wait, particularly after what happened to Senator Emil Jones III, Democrat, Chicago. The splashy federal bribery case against him completely fell apart at trial. Lots of folks, from Governor Pritzker on down, had demanded Jones resign when the indictment was issued. It also didn't help matters that, like with the Madigan probe, only House Republicans signed the petition to initiate action against Ammons. It can be portrayed as partisan. Ammons says she's innocent. I doubt she'll resign. So Speaker Welch is in a bit of a trick bag. Local and Nation on A3 prison for attempted murder. Gang member in home invasion gets 25 years. This article's by Tony Reed, Decatur. Another 25-year prison sentence was handed down to a member of the home invasion gang that shot it out with an armed Decatur mom fighting to protect her baby and young child. Defendant Colton Clark, 26, pleaded guilty to an amended attempted murder charge as part of a plea deal negotiated by defense attorney Susan Moorhead. Clark's case had been scheduled for a jury trial July 13th, but he made a June 15th appearance in Macon County Circuit Court and said he would take the deal. Judge Lindsay Shelton then agreed to dismiss further charges alleging home invasion involving the discharge of a firearm and aggravated battery. Previously in June, the then 16-year-old ringleader of the four-strong home invasion gang, Christopher M. Johnston, now 17, was also sentenced to 25 years when he pleaded guilty to a charge of attempted first-degree murder. The violence dates to around 4 a.m. on February 10, 2025, when the gang burst into a residence in the 700 block of South Stone Street. The woman, 22, was home alone and asleep with a premature baby, just a few months old, and a 2-year-old daughter. Awakened in terror, she responded by warning the gang she was armed and ordering them to get out of her home. Instead of leaving, they chose violence, the mother said in a victim impact statement at Johnston's sentencing. They opened fire. Shots were fired over and over again, more than 30 times, tearing through walls, windows, everything that once made my house feel like a home. The flying bullets also tore into the mother. She sustained a gunshot wound to her left forearm and right hip. The hip where she was holding her infant daughter. Her children escaped injury, however. Sworn affidavits filed by the Decatur Police Department said the mom's bravery and gunfire finally forced the home invaders to retreat and flee, but not before one of them was shot in the back, although he would live to survive his wound. The affidavit said the gang had earlier targeted another house in another part of Decatur, but had given up after blasting shots through the front door but failing in an attempt to force their way inside. Sentencing clerk Judge Shelton gave him a 16-month credit off his sentence for time previously spent in custody since his arrest, but the judge also ordered his 25-year prison sentence be served at 85%. Of the remaining defendants due or in the case, Deontay Stone, 25, is due back in court for a pretrial hearing August 5th on attempted murder and home invasion charges. He is also the gang member who was wounded, hit by a bullet in his lower back. Cesar Javier Jacinto, 25, had been due for a jury trial July 13th on the same set of charges, but that has been postponed. He is due back in court for a pretrial hearing August 6th. Both defendants remain in the custody of the Macon County Jail. Rust Belt factories' power bills surge. Big tech data centers are driving increase. Articles by Layla Kearney, Reuters, New York. For years, electricity costs for the Belden Brick Company in Sugar Creek, Ohio, had been relatively stable. Last year, they surged by 90%, largely because of rising power demand from data centers in the region. The 141-year-old brick manufacturer, whose products can be found in iconic buildings including the Texas Alamo and Notre Dame University, is seeing power bills rise mainly from a monthly capacity charge, which recently jumped from $1,600 a month to $12,000. Belden Brick is among many manufacturers across America's heartland where costs are rising as power-hungry data centers serving the artificial intelligence industry proliferate. Factory electricity bills, a core expense, are rising faster than for many homes and other businesses, according to a Reuters review of U.S. energy data and interviews with nearly a dozen manufacturers and industry advocates. Federal, state, and local governments responding to consumer anger and grid stability concerns are pushing big tech to pay more for their expected demand, but some of their proposals lump in smaller factories with tech giants such as Meta and Amazon, whose power needs can dwarf even large manufacturers by a factor of 50. Meta declined to comment. Amazon did not respond to a comment request. Capacity charges are designed to compensate power generators for ensuring the grid has enough electricity for peak usage and to spur development of new supply. They generally account for about 10% of residential bills, but can represent up to three times that for manufacturers, according to interviews with manufacturers, attorneys, and energy experts. Such fees have soared in the 13-state region covered by grid operator PJM interconnection due to stagnant supply and demand from data centers where one server warehouse can use as much electricity as a mid-sized town. That capacity charge jumped off the page, said company president Brad Belden, part of the fifth generation working the company. Despite such capacity charge hikes, PJM was forced to take emergency steps last week, including asking some users to curb electricity use to prevent rolling blackouts, and searing temperatures pushed peak demand to a new record. The rising cost and regulatory uncertainty threatened some factories' viability at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump is prioritizing domestic manufacturing, advocates and policy experts say. These businesses are considering raising prices, slowing growth, or in some cases, relocating. Belden has raised brick prices by 4% and profits have still shrunk. If bills keep rising, he said, local manufacturers may quickly reach limits on cost-cutting or price-hiking. There are going to be some companies that are on the razor's edge, Belden said. The White House said in a statement that Trump has taken action to cushion the blow on manufacturers, citing his hosting of tech companies signing a ratepayer protection pledge earlier this year and directives to build more power plants in PJM paid for by tech companies. And with that, we've come to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, July 14th, 2026. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour.